This works. Okay. My name is Trevor Johnson. I'm 46. Feel a lot older sometimes. Been married 22 years, have 4 kids. And today I want to give you a summary of the last 17 years focused on the jungles of Papua. So just for housekeeping, I barely know what's on my own mind. I don't know what's on yours. So ask any questions at any time. Maybe a brave soul will ask the first or so and get the ball rolling. I also brought you books. No charge if you read it, if you want to read it. I don't think every missionary needs to be an academic theologian, but every missionary needs to be theologically minded. And so hopefully this is proof of that. This is a book on spiritual warfare, Fight the Good Fight. It was just picked up by the largest Christian publisher in Indonesia. But you get it for free. And this is Wanted the World. Even though I believe in the sovereignty of God, I believe that God has an intense desire to see the lost saved. And so we are to mirror that desire when we go out and evangelize. So if you want to read it, go ahead and take a copy while they last. In 2004, I went to Papua for the first time. Got my first case of malaria then. Came back and I raised support. And we went out for good in 2006. And we did 3 terms. And then I almost died. And now I'm here. So that's the summary. I made a vow to God to reach the Korowai tribe with the gospel or die trying. And be careful what you promise to God, because he almost fulfilled both parts of that request. And it was a long journey. I wasn't even saved until I was 18. I grew up in southern Missouri. Y'all know what a hillbilly is. So hillbillies can sometimes make good jungle missionaries. Grow up poor and spend all your summers on the river and in the woods. And after God saved me, I got to do that for the glory of Jesus. So what could be better? I was saved at 18. I was suspicious of church. I think most churches in the States don't really give you the gospel. They give you an inoculation against the gospel. They give you enough religion to soothe your conscience, but not enough to actually show you what you need. And so there are millions of people inoculated against the true gospel in the States. And so I would go and I'd see the big wall charts about the end of the world, or people would be blabbering, speaking in tongues. And I just walked out of a lot of church services. But I knew there was something. I tried to be an atheist, and it really doesn't work, because your very being tells you that there is a God. Every drive of mankind has a fulfillment. We are hungry, and there's such a thing as food. We're thirsty, there's such a thing as drink. We get tired, we have sleep. There's a sex drive, and there's a legitimate fulfillment of that within marriage. But then I begin to read about the tribes of the world, and every single people in the world is religious. Mankind has a religious nature, unless the state comes in and wants to become God, and then you see state-enforced atheism. But religion is one of the drives of mankind, and where did those drives come from? We were created to know God. And so I began to read the New Testament, and doesn't sound very macho, but I fell in love with Jesus. There was never anybody that spoke like him, that taught like him. He came from heaven to earth, and he lived a poor life and suffered as a poor person would in that time. He suffered more. He suffered for our sins. And if he did all that, then surely we can buy a plane ticket, right? Mm-hmm. Surely we can canoe for Jesus in the jungle. And so we arrived in Papua, did a lot of surveys, and before I even entered the Korowai area, there was a 70-year-old Highland Papuan pastor. In the highlands of Papua, the gospel was planted in the 60s, 70s, and 80s among the tribes such as the Dani and the Yali tribes. And this old 70-year-old Dani pastor went down to the Korowai. They almost shot him 3 or 4 times with arrows, but he lived in a treehouse with them for 6 months. He treated a few people for malaria. They were healed. And the tribe invited him to come back and to bring his friends. And so at a regional wide church conference, this old pastor pulls me out of my chair and announces to everybody, this is the next missionary to the Korowai. I was Shanghaied into it. So, and the church said amen, and they prayed for me. And I thought, well, you know what? God does work through the will of the church. And the church is speaking with one voice. I need to get down there and see this tribe. And so 2007, 2008, we built our house. Now, the Korowai tribe, the National Geographic calls them the treehouse people. They build their houses about 20 or 30 feet off the ground. Some of the magazines will have them like 100 feet up, but they don't know that the tribe does that for the photos. So it became a big scandal. It actually became a big scandal because some anthropologists told on them that the BBC was actually giving extra gifts to get them to build these tree houses up 100 foot or so. But the normal tree house is 20 or 30 foot off the ground. Now, here's your first chance for audience interaction. Why do you think they build their houses 20 or 30 feet off the ground? Wild animals. Any other guesses? Tsunamis, floods. Those are the two most common answers. But the real answer is they build their houses off the ground because they're afraid of witches. It's tied in with their animistic belief. So the central pole has a special bundle of leaves is buried under that central pole. And sometimes up at the top, you have a special leaves. I guess you'd call it anti-witch repellent. So animistic fear grips the Korowai. You all know what animism is? It's a belief that there are spiritual forces in nature, trees, rocks, such as that, and that you can gain their favor by ritualistic behaviors. In short, it's almost like they have forgotten the creator God and they've gone to appeasing the lesser spirits. So in our area, they're in fear of Wallapool, so they do things to appease the spirit because they're afraid. And then they're afraid of the witches as well. That's a Korowai. They're violent people. It's hard to rationalize with them. Usually discussion ends in intimidation. The anthropologists call it brinkmanship. Think of the Cold War. The Soviet Union would push a little bit to gain concessions. The United States would push a little bit back to gain a little bit. That's how the Korowai, they push and push in order to gain a little bit. And if you're nice to them, they walk all over you. So it's you go to love a people for the sake of the gospel. It's hard to like some people. Mm-hmm. And so the Korowai are violent. They're unhealthy. They have child brides. The phrase is, I have raised her up to be my wife. When a baby girl is born, they put a mark on her, put a bracelet or some way to mark her as belonging to this other clan. The parents will trade, barter, and then sometimes as young as 9, 10, 11 years old, she will go into the house of her husband, who is sometimes 30, 35, 40 years old. She often goes kicking and screaming. So that's hardly consent. So the Korowai have child brides as well. So they're animistic. They have child brides. They try to solve things with the bows and arrows. So quite a lovable people, right? How do you reach them? They're 99% illiterate. They're scattered, probably the size of this greater area, Marble Falls to Burnett, 4,000 people spread out over lowland jungle. And I mean, hundreds of square kilometers of dense lowland jungle. Along the river, we put ourselves in the village of Donawage. But if I were to hike around this area, it'd take 2 weeks, morning till dark. And it's not like here, although I fell in a cactus last time I was here. So, you know, so it can be pretty arduous here as well. But we're talking about mud up to your ankles, sometimes up to your knee. I once crossed a swamp for about an hour, wading up to my chin. I could see the mosquitoes buzzing. So it's just a hard, physically hard area to get from one place to another. But in the central village of Donawage along the river, I can take the canoe up and down, and I can also reach every post within a 12-hour hike. So what we did was this old Donnie pastor, this Papuan, and these Papuans, you know, they can hike without shoes. They're hiking barefoot days and days through the jungle to take the gospel to another tribe. So we talk about the sacrifices of Western missionaries. You're only hearing about the sacrifices of Western missionaries is because these fellows are not writing this stuff down. They're not going to churches. They're out there sweating and suffering. So I'm actually writing a book this year. And one of the reasons is so that the voice of these evangelists will be heard. And we talk about missionary attrition. Anybody hear that phrase? Missionary attrition means missionary couples go overseas. They run into financial problems, marriage problems, stress problems, and then they come home off the field. That's a loss, a premature loss. That counts as missionary attrition. It's about 5% per person per year for Western missionaries. That means in about 5 years' time, half of missionaries come home. So in the Coronawai, we worked with about two dozen Dani evangelists and about another dozen or so airstrip workers, probably 40, 45 people and their families. We buried eight of them. So we've had about eight out of 45 die. So when we talk about missionary attrition, it means a lot different when it comes to these tribes. It's not just a couple stressing out and coming back to America. There we have the wife of an evangelist buried in our village, the children of evangelists buried in our village. So there's a cost to this. You know, Jesus said, take up your cross, not your cushion, right? And I knew there would be a cost, but to know it theoretically is a lot different than to experience it yourself. I'd rather know it from a book myself. I'd rather know it from other people's trials, not my own. So what we did was I was in the middle here, and we put these Dani evangelists. We got a team of about two dozen Dani Christians from the highlands, and we put them out in these posts with a shortwave radio. So every day they could call in if there was a great amount of disease or whatnot. My wife and I are nurses. I was in the military. Military trains you, especially in preparation for wartime, something you'd call ditch medicine. Kind of very down and dirty stabilization and such to get the patient evacuated. So if there was somebody sick or injured or they had a fight or whatnot, they'd call me by radio. I'd hike out with a rucksack full of medicine, have a satellite phone and a GPS. And if the patient needed transport to the city for machine-dependent care, I'd call in the GPS coordinates to the helicopter in Wamana in the central. There was a missionary helicopter there, and they'd come in. We'd take the patient to a creek bed, or we'd cut out an area the size of a volleyball court. And the banana trees are soft. The helicopter rotors just cuts off the banana trees, and then it'd come down and we'd transport the patient. So my life for the first couple of years was just constant trekking, circulating this area, trying to explain the gospel through picture books. How do you evangelize in illiterate people like this? So we over and over show pictures, and then God works triumph from tragedy. You know, Obed, he was shot with arrows. Johannes Erlach nursed him up. Obed began to learn Indonesian, became our first translator. We begin to have other translators that begin to learn the wider language of Indonesian to communicate. And it was just week after week and month after month and year after year of the same pattern. And of course, every couple months I'd get malaria or so. The end of our first term, we had one convert. You read missionary biographies, and sometimes 7, 10, 14 years, people will wait for the first person to come to faith. And of course, I talked about missionary attrition. If half the missionaries are coming home at year number 5 or 6, they're coming home before they ever see any fruit. You almost have to be in a place for a decade. And for tribal people, you got to live with the tribal people day in and day out, every day, for years to see any sort of change. And those changes are very slow. So Condreas was our first convert who promptly died. And when he died, he gathered his friends around him. And the tribe wanted to do their animistic rituals on him, but he refused. And the Donnie evangelist, one of the, a lady lived with us to minister to the children, parent, a Donnie lady. She tried to pray for him, and they pulled her out of Condreas's hut by her hair. But at night, he knew he was dying. He crawled out of his hut. He gathered his friends around him, and he says, I know I'm going to die, but I believe in Jesus. I'm going to heaven. You must believe in Jesus too. And those young men that witnessed that, all except for one, those young men became the base of the church. Why he was there, the first young man I baptized, and he just graduated Bible school about 8 months ago. So that was the first term, one convert who died. And then my wife got chikungunya, a tropical virus, paralyzed her lower limbs, had to carry her for a while. We got pregnant and had a miscarriage because of that tropical virus. So our first term, we hurriedly tried to go to Singapore for medical care. And an hour after we arrived, she began to hemorrhage, almost bled to death in the back of the taxi cab on the way to the hospital. So that's how we came home, came our victorious first term. So second term, we got pregnant and immediately had another miscarriage. Once we got back on the field, had dengue fever, had 105.6 fever. I read an article about what LSD users, they have these major big trips or whatnot. I got all that for free. I got dengue fever. I don't remember 3 or 4 days out of my life. I do remember flying through the air. So I got that experience for free, I guess. And then after I healed, it was back hitting the trail again. Every day, trying to take the gospel to somebody, trying to explain it to somebody. And then you just kind of sit there at night, me and my wife, is anything ever going to change? You know, the sound of the bugs is overpowering, and the people are curious about us, and we are healing some sick people, but is there any change that's going to happen here? And you just begin to wonder. And, you know, what kept us going was kind of the curiosity, because we had the privilege. This is one of the last tribes in the world that has had limited contact with the outside world. So it's surreal. Everything I did, the mark of surprise, the men would do this and suck in their breath. As a, like, so I'd show them some gadget and there'd be all these tribal men standing around me going like this. I put suntan lotion on and they were whispering, oh, that's what makes the skin white. So I gave some guys flashlights at night to hunt with me because our first several years, you know, you want to be a missionary, you go to Bible school. There's a whole lot of stuff Bible school doesn't cover, you know, how to fix your generator, how to install solar paneling, what to do when a man and his two wives come to you and wants you to catechize both of his wives. You know, very strange scenarios. Like I said, it's surreal. We wrapped our house in mosquito net, so there would be screens around our house, and we had a front porch. At all hours of the day, the tribal people would stare through the screens all day. We were like the human zoo. My wife would cook something, would do something. We had like a mixer that we, one of those, you know, so we didn't use batteries, and they'd all be outside doing this. We know, oh, this must interest them. I hear them beating their chest outside. So that kept us going. It was just kind of a bizarre life. Walk through the woods and come upon a group of, the people still wore leaves, women were topless and wore grass skirts, come upon them bailing out a stream. They have a sago palm tree and the bark is like a big shovel. So they dam up a little stream, they bail out the water, and on the bottom, the little minnows would wiggle and they'd pick up the minnows to take them home to eat them. So I'd come upon them and they'd look at me with fear and they threw everything up in the air and ran off through the forest. And I'd hear him say, Tadayo Aline, white demon. But a year later, I saw the same group, and one of them, I heard him say, Tadayo Aline, Yani Yanope. So Yanope is the word for human, so I got a promotion. I was upgraded to personhood. So that was life for the first couple of years, just kind of bizarre, surreal. I couldn't get a washing machine to work. My wife did the wash in the creek. We sometimes we had candlelight dinners, not romantic in the jungle, just because of the lack of electricity. And of course, the bugs would surround any light. So the candlelight, there'd be a circling nest of gnats at night. Do you have any questions for me so far about the tribe or life in the tribe? Again, it was hard, but it was also good. We had a good, every missionary needs a good swimming hole. And so I take the kids swimming sometimes two or three times a day. So that was very pleasant as well.
Did you even attempt to try to teach them any kind of English, or they like don't want to?
No, they learned a couple phrases for the benefit of guests later, but years later.
Liquor?
Years later. Yeah, years later. They got to learn to read and write in their own language first, and then the broader language of Indonesian as well. And so English is some years off, maybe.
Did you go there with any of that language?
No. The first year we learned formal Indonesian in a language school in Java. And then we went to Papua, and they have a different dialect, like a hillbilly dialect of Indonesian. And then I began to learn Korowai, but I never got fluent in it. I had to write down everything I was going to say. And if you write anything down there, the sweat starts in your armpits, and it rolls down your elbows, rolls down your hands onto your paper, and your paper just dissolves because it's so hot there, you know. It's hot and wet, and hotter and wetter is the climate, 14 foot of rain per year. So any of my notes would just dissolve because of the sweat. So we had these big oatmeal boxes, and if I ever preached in Korowai, I'd write down phonetically the Korowai language on these oatmeal boxes. So you see these old paintings of Moses coming off of Mount Sinai with the tablets. That's what I'd come out here with these my two big oatmeal boxes trying to read Korowai.
They're all Quakers.
Now they're all Quakers. Yeah, Uncle Ben. So that might be good considering they're pinching for warfare. So, what are the questions do you have about the tribe or the work?
Mm-hmm. So they do have a written language?
Nope.
They don't? So.
No, Indonesian does. So you really have to decide what's your strategy.
Right.
So like Wycliffe Bible translators, they have this belief that the people need to hear in the heart language. That's good, but we don't see the Apostle Paul ministering in every local Greek dialect. We see him using the trade language of the day, Koine. And so I believe Indonesian is a sufficient vehicle for now. And we do have plans. We have a group of young believers, young men, that we're going to send to get linguistic training. So that's still further, you know. The whole church planting spectrum, it takes multiple generations, right? We're used to this easy believism in the West, which does not work. But mission work takes decades. And often you get converts, and then you try to form a church. That itself takes decades sometimes, and then later, usually there is a translation. Very rarely does all that occur in one missionary's lifetime, especially if he lives in a malarial area. The definition of a lifetime may vary depending on the location, right? So we begin to wonder, are we ever going to see any results here? We have some people interested. Are they interested in our Jesus or in our medicine? And then we begin to see some things. We begin to see some of these young men, they were taking food out. In the past, if you got sick and died, your body and your treehouse would rot together and people would just avoid you. They'd just leave your body to rot in your treehouse. But then we started seeing these young men, oh, you're taking food out. They must be family. You know, I'm thinking, oh, they must be your own clan. And these young men started giggling, oh, actually, we used to fight them. They used to be our enemies, but they're sick, so we need to take them food. And so then I knew something was happening here. If you're half starved and willing to part with some of your own food, that's something major. And then at first, the kids would just stare at me through the cracks in the huts. They did not really play. We cleared out an area. Finally, we began to get kids coming to play with our kids. The men would come still wearing their leaves, their traditional garb. they'd be carrying their bows and arrows and kind of loitering around the trees, you know, out of reach with their bows and arrows, just kind of watching. But by the end of our first term and into our second term, sometimes we'd have 100 people in our front yard. And they'd be playing tag. Pretty soon the men, you know, the leaves slowly became shorts. And then the bows and arrows begin to disappear. And then here's these men from different clans all playing volleyball together. And they're playing tag. And I'm like, what kind of tag they're playing? They're playing witch tag. Like, this object of fear has now become a childhood game. An object of mockery. And I don't know what your opinions on Halloween is, but I think maybe the same dynamic there happened, that a culture that feared spirits and such began to mock and ridicule them as a sign of victory over them. Whether that's legitimate or not, I don't know, but it's not salvation, but it is good to see kids joking about the witches instead of being fearful of them. Mm-hmm.
What kind of Muslim influence do you have?
It's only now. They were closed off to the outside world, but as the outside world opens up, we actually finally had the government sent us a teacher in full burqa, a Muslim teacher. So the evangelist sent her home, said thank you, but no thanks. And then we began to redouble our efforts to form a private Christian school, which we have. And after the school was founded, after the airstrip was founded, we had Muslim groups come in and try to offer bags of rice to some of our people to convert, to say the Shahada. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. And but Salomo, one of our believers, said, well, yes, rice is good, but whether I am full or whether I'm hungry, I belong to Jesus. And so he rejected this offer, and for a tribal, half-starved tribal group to reject any food is an achievement. So that shows the maturity of the believers. So that felt good. But it is, Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country, 270 million people. The Papuans are just a vast minority out in the middle of the jungle. And there are efforts to Islamify all of Papua as well. So we must reach them first. Well, what other questions do you have?
Mm-hmm. Do you eat what they eat?
I sure tried. So what the missionary hint, where he leads, I'll follow, and what he feeds me, I'll swallow. And the Korowai, I eat everything. So rats, bats, turtles, sago grub worms, spiders, crickets, grasshoppers. They never eat earthworms because earthworm is a bad word. Wafos is their biggest cuss word, because the sago grub worm, we eat it to stay alive. But when we die, the earthworm eats us. So the grub worm is a symbol of life and the earthworm is a symbol of death. And so if someone stubs their toe, you hear them yelling, Wafos, earthworm. Like, okay, that's interesting. Or Ging, the river spirit. So if you stub your toe, maybe substitute your normal word for waffles. Yeah. What other
questions? How did you keep your nursing license?
We thought about it, but then we're like, yeah, why bother? We're out in the middle of the boonies. All those continuing education credits about, you know, machine dependent nursing. We don't have any machines there. So it's all pretty primitive sort of stuff. So, mm-hmm.
So who's flying in there? Is it MAFN?
Mission Aviation Fellowship, yeah. And JARS, the wing from Wycliffe Bible Translators. So when we got there, we were 5 days walk from the nearest town with an automobile. There was no government presence, no roads, no electricity, no stores, just nothing but jungle. And so we actually had the governor come and visit us, and he announced to everybody that before the government ever stepped foot in this region, it was the missionaries and the church that entered it first. And so that was nice to hear and nice to see published in the paper as well. But we opened a water strip, pulled out the logs, float plane would come in, and maybe some of you folks go to Walmart 3 or 4 times a week, right? And I imagine having 4 kids, or at least 2 at that point, 1 or 2 at that point, and you got to count every kilogram, and you only go shopping like once every 10 weeks, once every 12 weeks. So we were like, do we put in another pound of flour on this flight, or is that another book for Noah? Hmm. So you really, there is a lot of logistical challenges when you're trying to live in the jungle. You know, we're the richest people in 5 days walk, but we're living pretty grubby as well. So, what other questions do you have?
Mm-hmm. Is the Bible, you feel like the Bible is changes a person that does the kind of work that you do in a different way? It reads more, I guess, it reads differently, I'm just going to say.
I have gotten more out of the scriptures by living overseas. Like one instance is in the Old Testament, there's an awful lot of verses about God will not let my foot be dashed against a stone. I'm like, okay, this is a culture that wore sandals barefoot. You know, they were concerned getting stubbing your toe or stepping on a rock or a root is a major concern in that culture. But, you know, in America in 2021, hardly anybody's worried, oh, God, protect me from having my foot dashed against a stone, because we have good footwear, right? So reading the scripture and living in a tribal society illuminates a lot. Mm-hmm. All the verses about shared meals, about the parables about somebody coming, knocking on your door at night for housing, because there's no hotels in the jungle. You reach a post and you're like, please somebody put me up. Because even the tribal people don't want to be caught after dark in the jungle. That even scares them. That's pretty intimidating to be caught.
What do the people think when you share, like, Paul landing on that island and getting bit by a snake?
Oh, the story portions, really, the tribal people really like that.
Yeah.
And the Old Testament wars, they took an interest in as well. They'd say things like, oh, they're just like us. I'm like, exactly. That's why you need Jesus too. So a pattern emerged. We have these young believing men. Monday or Tuesday, they would converge on Danawage from their posts. I'd teach them these Bible stories. Wednesday or Thursday, they'd parrot or teach the Bible stories back to me so that I knew they comprehended it. And then Friday or Saturday, we'd disperse, and I'd usually preach in Danawage or circulate with some of these Korowai. And that way in Danawage, but the surrounding villages, there'd be some measure of a understandable gospel witness throughout the region. Sometimes I'd go with them. The tribal guys would tag team. It was not always good. One time they were preaching on Noah and the Ark, and they got into a big argument about whether they got to termites were on the ark, because the termites would eat the boat and then the boat would sink. And, you know, they're arguing back and forth while the people are, I'm like, guys, table that discussion for later. We'll talk about it. Just stay focused. So every opportunity was an opportunity to teach. I'd always bring a Highland Donnie evangelist with me and Lowland Korowai Christians, because I believe the training for ministry has to be done in the context of ministry. The seminary classroom setting just lacks something, you could learn. It's like learning how to fly from a book, you know. It's got to be hands-on. And so every week they'd gather, go through another story, they'd disperse again. And then finally, we were trying to teach people how to read, but they really came to us and says, Bapa, we are trying to teach the word of God to these villages, and we don't know how to read it ourselves. And that was when I redoubled the efforts to form a school. Jimmy, one of the evangelists, had been opening a school, but it was kind of towards the kids and not really well organized. But we really saw the need after that. And then that was our second furlough. My wife's immune system kind of broke down, and we got what you'd call a nutritional assessment. And despite eating like athletes, she was not absorbing anything, because your guts have these little villi things, right? These little tentacle things that absorb your food. And if you've had dysentery and giardia about 8 to 10 times over the past decade, those little villi get paralyzed or hurt, and things just kind of pass through you. So you're eating, but you're not absorbing. So we took some time to get her stomach back in order, and then we went back. And our third term, we got this school established. every day at 4 p.m. would beat on a cooking pot. We'd beat on a kettle. It'd go clang, clang, clang. And then that way people could hear that medical clinic was happening. They'd come to our porch. I'd treat them. If they were too sick, I'd hike out to treat them at their spot, at their houses. But we saw the need to begin to nationalize everything. We needed Indonesians to take over because I became very aware. In short, I began to earn enemies in the government. For instance, everything becomes political in some areas. So the president of Indonesia declares victory over leprosy. So I send the health department two pictures of lepers downstream. I'm like, you guys are fudging the numbers in this area. There are lepers here. Oh, no, that's worms. I'm like, this is textbook leprosy. So then they send in a team and somebody, and they get mad at me because I exposed their number fudging. And then illegal gold mining began to happen, and they began to dump mercury in the water supply. And then what do I do? So we got the mine closed twice through sending photos of the damage and the yellowing of the river and even water samples. We got it closed twice, and now there's laws that the people must be fairly compensated and no use of mercury anymore. Because the game just fled. People were starving. Of course, back here in the States, I had some Reformed Baptist pastors call me a social justice warrior. And, you know, if a Korowai gets mad at you and swings a machete at you, that makes for a bad day, but it's easier to forgive. But when your friends are stabbing you in the back and calling you a social justice warrior for trying to avoid your people being poisoned, that's quite a bitter pill. And it makes you seethe in anger. But we got it closed. But it earned me enemies as well. I had people create hate websites against me. There's a website saying Trevor Johnson is a CIA agent sent to spread dissension in Indonesia. And you look at it, and it has a picture of me. I think it has a picture of me treating a tribal woman medically. And it has a picture of my daughter reading to tribal kids. And my wife's like, we look like a real dangerous bunch, don't we? So if you can't go for popularity, I guess go for notoriety, right? So if bad people hate you, maybe you're doing something right. But we had some people thrown in jail, two helicopters from the mine confiscated, people fined. It was a partial victory. But it was in the midst of that, I began to get very sick. The last Sunday before I got too sick to function, we took the Lord's Supper. We had 24 baptized believers just in Donawagi, not including the surrounding areas. But every case of malaria, my spleen began to swell. Case number 19, 20, 22, it got bigger. The doctors are saying it's just a matter of time before it swells and busts. That could kill you. How many times do I have left? And by case number 24, I just basically dry heaved and threw up all day. I couldn't even walk. We had to call the mission plane. The kids were able to pack what they could fit in their backpack. I crawled to the mission airplane, and then we left. And that was in the middle of 2018. And I guess it's been 3 years, and two out of that 3 years has been agony, severe, severe pain. My liver was swollen. They said they had a liver of a chronic alcoholic without all the fun, I guess. But, you know, 10 months later, after eating good, my liver function test said my lab tests were like that of an 18-year-old. So your liver, you know, the body can regenerate. It can go from almost kaput to brand new just within a year if you eat clean. But my liver was swollen, my spleen was swollen, my gallbladder was swollen, had four other parasites, including strongyloidiasis. If it proliferates, it's got about a 90% mortality rate. Had a spot in my brain, had high levels of mercury. Wonder where that came from. So I just, it's such agonizing pain that no matter how tired I got, I could not sleep. I would beat my head against the tile floor trying to knock myself out, and I could not. And then I thought, I'm gone. Everything's going to collapse. I'm going to see the end of everything here. In the meantime, a journalist trekked through my area and said, missionaries are killing off the Korowai tribe because he didn't understand. You have these longhouses. The Korowai build these longhouses for grubworm feasts. They use it once and then they leave it. So this journalist, Russian journalist, went through and saw these abandoned houses. And they're like, oh, people are dying off because of the missionaries. But I know there's never been more little fat babies than now. I took a photo. I took a photo about 14 years ago of Korowai youth, 12, 14, 16, 18 years old, 14 years ago. To this day, every one of them, except for one that we shipped out for schooling, is dead. So life is nasty, brutish, and short among the tribal group. You watch the nature programs and they'll say, oh, this tribe, they live in harmony with nature. That's baloney. They don't live in harmony. They fight nature tooth and nail and they lose. They got tuberculosis. They got malaria. There's not gray-headed people there. I'm an old man. People are, well, why did you get malaria 24 times? It's because I'm still alive. The tribal people, not a lot of them live to an old age, but that's changing. And now we see more babies than we ever have. But to get that criticism while you're sick is severe. And but laying in bed, depressed, in pain, I begin to get these Facebook messages. This boy that grew up in wearing leaves in his treehouse. Oh, Bapa, I just finished school. Pray for me. I want to go to Bible school next year. So that's an encouragement. And then you saw this film. Some of the teachers like, I know your plan last year before you got sick was to send a teacher to this village and open this school. We went ahead and did it for you. So my coworkers took initiative. I thought everything would die, but they kind of took over the work. And this video, it's called Trevor Johnson Ministries. Every time I hear that, it makes me cringe. Because I'm like, a minister should never have a ministry named after him. That sounds vain. But they named it for me. And they said, you're a sit. Don't argue with us. And so they got me to speak for 20 seconds. And they made this film. They've hired teachers for me. Now there's a team. And the work is expanding like it never has before. In my absence. I don't know how to feel about that. It's good, but it's bad too. You know, God does not need us.
Oh. I've heard you said that the goal of every missionary is to work yourself out of a job.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that's what you're doing.
Yes, we're trying. We have people being trained to become evangelists. They've graduated Bible school to take over the churches. We are trying to get nurses and teachers trained to send back to their communities. My end goal was to see a Korowai church of Korowai sheep led by Korowai shepherds. So we've reached the goal. The mission was a success. I just came back totally. The man was a mess, but the mission was a success, is I guess how you could put it. I came back in extreme pain. Loud noises would make me dry heave. People would eyeball me like, this guy is just weird now. You know, he's not the same person as he was when he left. And that's very humbling to have your physical body and your emotions totally devastated by the work. But Jesus is worth it. And I just get pictures of little Korowai girls that before I'd almost have to fight guys to get them to have their girls go to school. They'd stand and block the path sometimes, try to intimidate these girls. And now we have over a dozen little Korowai girls living in my house wearing my kids' dresses and playing with their toys. So that's a sweet consolation when we had to leave everything behind. So in summary, we have a church planted. We have a school, a medical clinic, a dormitory / orphanage, and then we reopened the school in the village of Fuao, sent two teachers and a nurse there. We have three preschools. This year, we're building teachers' housing, a new dorm, two new dorms, because too many kids are a great problem to have. Too many kids are coming in. We have to build more facilities. So everything is expanding. Everything, it's a success. It's just, I'm still struggling with my health. I went one time at a church last year and I puked afterwards, and I had a church hear about it and drop me. And then a month later, another church say, in light of your ongoing illness, we're going to drop you in 3 months. All right, guys, you know, the work has never expanded as it has now. It's just, I look like I'm in a terrible mess. And it's, you know, it's not for a pastor or a missionary to admit any sort of weakness, depression. That's a risky thing, because not everybody will judge you sympathetically. And so I experienced great depression from the extreme pain. And my kids struggled as well. My son, he used to wrestle and jump in the creek every break between classes. And then we had to enroll him in a regular school. And boys can't sit through 10 hours of school unless you drug them with Adderall. You know, boys got to be running. So I was like, Noah, you got to shape up or I'm going to put you in the military school. And he went online and he saw the boys fighting with pugil sticks and crawling under barbed wire. He's like, Dad, this looks pretty cool. So now he's in military school. He's the captain of the football team. He's doing good. My daughter, she's struggling. She says she loves Jesus, but if God is good, why does he allow so much suffering? And if you work for God, why did he almost kill you several times? I go, well, because I'm nothing, but, you know. But she's struggling over the problem of pain and problem of evil, which is a problem, but only a problem that Christians can answer. But again, if you open the door a crack and you admit to any weakness in your personal life, that can be a very tricky thing. But, you know, we're no better than you. And moving overseas really affects somebody. Coming back is probably harder than going. Coming back to America, we came back for 6 weeks for COVID and then all the borders closed. And then I'm sitting there in Walmart staring at the paper towel aisle. And I'm like, I'm talking to my wife saying, there's a paper towel aisle. The paper towel aisle is bigger than most stores overseas. And there's 2-ply, there's 3-ply, there's a family pack, there's quilted, there's scented. You know, there's more paper towel choices than we have choices for anything overseas, and it just is paralyzing. And I've struggled here.
Mm-hmm. Trevor, on the, you were talking about the animism and they're scared of all these witches and stuff. Do they have, and what is their understanding of creation? Why are they?
They think that maybe Wallapool created it, but the idea of a creator God who is all good and created all things out of nothing, that's a new idea. The germ theory of disease is a new idea. If you suddenly get sick, it's got to be witchcraft. So it's not because you're dirty or, you know, some of my church announcements were don't poop in the part of the creek where you drink. So, you know, hopefully you don't have to send those, but, you know, to know that you have to drink upstream, that sort of basic knowledge is still new to them, you know, how disease is spread. Anybody have any final questions here? I've given you a summary.
What are your support needs? How then, other than praying and keeping in touch, what is the support that you need?
I lost $1,000 of support last year, a month. So my W-2, I brought in a lot for the school, but my W-2 read 23,000. So maybe Biden needs to give me some government cheese or something, maybe. Get on one of those programs. But we decided to recover in Malaysia because it's a top Asian medical tourism spot. And we could live on easy there. And here back, I mean, the price of beef, the price of gas, the price of lumber, everything is skyrocketing. So it's been tough here lately. And our plans, we're trying to get back if we can get a visa. And I tried to go back 18 months ago and they put me in jail and deported me. that's what happens if you mess with their gold mining. So the future is uncertain, and that's not really not a good PR move to say, I have no idea what we're doing, but we're trying to get back. We have an immigration lawyer hired. We've been invited to India, to Thailand, to East Timor, to Palau. We've been invited like 8 different places, but my heart is still in Papua. But maybe the first phase of church planting is done. Maybe the Bible translation and stuff can happen by the next person. I don't know. But I need to finish up. Any last pressing issues? I'd like to thank you very much. It's very nice to be able to see a church every 5 or 6, I think in this case, 7 years, and to be able to report success, to be able to report gospel fruit at no matter what the cost. So Jesus is worth it. He's been good to all of us. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.